Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few minutes, meteorologist Alan Czarnecki of the University of Northern Iowa on why this polar vortex has delivered the most extreme winter weather in years. We'll also hear from Grant Gerlach with an education update. Before that, yesterday, lawmakers at the Iowa State House heard testimony on a bill that would create the possibility of parole for some Iowans serving a life sentence. Let's find out more about this legislation from Kate Payne, our Eastern Iowa reporter. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
So now those with life sentences have no hope for parole?
That's correct. So right now, those who are convicted of those most serious felonies in the state can't get parole. They're sentenced to life without parole. The one exception is they can apply to the governor to commute their sentence. So that's the one option that they have to be ultimately released. And this bill would change that.
Talk a little bit more about the details in this bill. What changes would it make, and how would it, I guess the review process would be a key part of this, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So currently, these individuals can apply to the governor for a commutation every 10 years after they've served 25. And this bill speeds up that timeline so they can apply every 3 years. And it also creates this new review committee that would look at these applications, hold hearings, and hold interviews with the applicants, and ultimately make recommendations to the governor and to the Board of Parole. And those recommendations can ultimately be forwarded to a district court, which could also choose to resentence the person or to uphold their life sentence.
Mm-hmm. Does the bill stipulate or give indication as to what type of life sentences being served would be given the possibility of parole over others? These are the most serious crimes, people incarcerated for these crimes.
Yeah, so this refers to Class A felonies. So again, the most serious crimes in the state of Iowa, such as first-degree murder, first-degree sexual abuse, first-degree kidnapping. But it does seem, how the bill is situated now, it seems to leave a lot up to the discretion of the governor, certainly, and to this the discretion of the committee. One thing that the bill really details is the different factors that they hope the committee will take into account, both factors that contributed to the initial crime itself, such as if the individual was under the influence of drugs or was a victim of abuse themselves, if they were suffering from mental illness, but also the steps that they've taken over the course of their life in prison, whether they trust authority at this point, whether they've consider themselves responsible, have made amends, have rehabilitated themselves.
I have to believe that victims' rights groups are weighing in.
Absolutely. So during the hearing for the bill yesterday, there's a whole swath of representatives speaking on this bill, including the County Attorneys Association, which is very strongly against this, saying that life without parole should be the alternative to the death penalty, which, of course, is abolished in the state of Iowa. And the county attorney saying that for victims and their families, having someone sentenced to life without parole, that's justice for them. But we also heard some very, very compelling testimony all around, but also from other victims and organizations representing them who don't speak for all victims, certainly, but saying that they would like to see this bill move forward. One advocate saying that for her and for her family, being responsible for someone being incarcerated for the rest of their life is not going to make them better. It's not going to help them as individual survivors.
Kate Payne, this bill is still being crafted, still being debated. Nevertheless, is there any sort of ballpark figures of how many people in Iowa prisons this might affect?
So speakers at the hearing were talking in the manner of hundreds of people, but over and again, including advocates, were really underscoring this is not for everyone. This is truly, they believe, should be for the absolutely most deserving, for folks who have had such a transformation, as the bill sponsor said, that they're not the same person that they were when they committed that crime. So really looking for fundamental changes in these individuals to earn this release.
Mm-hmm. Any sense at this point on how much support this bill has, how likely it is to become law?
So there's a really interesting bipartisan group of lawmakers who are supporting this bill, folks that you're unlikely to see together on many other pieces of legislation. But at the subcommittee hearing yesterday, those lawmakers said they weren't quite ready to weigh in on the bill yet, and that they need to have more conversations and to debate it further. So not really clear what the path forward is right now.
Interesting. Very interesting nonetheless. Kate Payne, our Eastern Iowa reporter, talking about a bill that would create the possibility of parole for some Iowans serving a life sentence. Thanks for the update, Kate.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, Professor of Meteorology Alan Czarnecki joins us to talk about why this polar vortex has delivered the most extreme winter weather in years. Before that, the cold, also something students in Iowa schools are having to deal with, in addition, of course, to worries over COVID. An education update from Grant Gerlach now, our Central Iowa reporter. Hi, Grant.
Hi, Ben.
Yesterday, the first day that K-12 schools in Iowa must offer that 100% in-person instruction for families that want it. Quickly, again, remind us of the background on that law.
Yeah, this was passed quickly last month by the legislature and signed immediately by Governor Kim Reynolds. This has been a priority for her, for schools to be 100% fully in person, or at least provide that option. So that became official on Monday. Schools have to provide the option for 5 days a week, fully in-person learning for families that want it. Families can still choose online learning, but there has to be an option for the kids to go in person every day. Mm-hmm. And that's what schools were headed to. Most schools already were providing something like that, but there were a handful of districts, including Des Moines, Dubuque, Urbandale, some others, that weren't doing that yet, but were on track to do it by this week.
Mm-hmm. Right, but the cold interfered as well in some school districts, didn't it?
Well, it did. So, for instance, Des Moines canceled school. Well, they didn't cancel it. They had virtual school yesterday because of the cold weather. They have virtual school again today. They're hoping to start the fully in-person model on Wednesday. Dubuque didn't have school yesterday. They had a two-hour late start today because of the cold. So it did sort of throw a wrench in the beginning of this whole change, but they'll get back to it once it warms up a little bit. And just to give you an idea of the impact in Des Moines, for instance, of this change, they'll plan to have a little more than 20,000 students going in person, which is about 65% of all their students. The rest would be all online. And this change, so that 65%, that's about 5% more than were in person under the hybrid plan. Mm. So that's the breakdown for Des Moines, which was one of the districts that had resisted these kinds of mandates from the state.
In your reporting, you spoke with a Des Moines teacher, a fifth grade teacher. What did you find out from her about her concerns at this point?
She's really trying to focus on the positive and the things that in-person learning could provide for some of her students. She knows that some of them will be helped by this. They just weren't doing very well with the virtual learning. But she does still have concerns about the virus spreading in her classroom. She'll have about 18 kids, and they won't be able to be 6 feet apart, as guidelines would hopefully allow to prevent COVID-19 from spreading. They'll have masks on, but still at that distance, she's afraid that there could be some viral spread in her classroom. Mm-hmm. She has had her first round of a COVID-19 vaccine, which she said was a great relief to her.
Mm. Okay, let's touch on a couple of other education issues at the legislature. Governor Reynolds putting a priority on passing this school choice legislation this year. This is the voucher-style program, shifting public school funding to private schools. Where does that stand now?
It passed in the Senate the end of last month. It hasn't moved at all in the House yet. That could be because they've been focused on school funding, Speaker Pat Grassley said, before they got around to talking about vouchers or charter schools. They wanted to deal with the school funding legislation, school funding bill, which is supposed to be among the first things they deal with every year. So they're getting that wrapped up in the House at this point. That means they could move on to school funding, but even if they have the time for it, it's not clear whether there's much appetite for that bill, at least as a complete package in the House side.
And remind us, what do opponents of the bill argue?
Well, so there are a few big changes that this would include. One is the scholarship accounts, which would be like vouchers for families to spend at private schools. Another is a much broader charter school program and increased open enrollment across the state. And opponents, particularly when it comes to the vouchers, look at this as a shift in public funding to private schools that they just don't accept. For instance, this isn't new funding for private schools. It would follow the student from their assigned public school. So they look at it as, a loss of funding for public schools when they really can't afford it, and they say it's not going to help those schools improve if students leave and the funding goes with them.
Mm-hmm. Last week, you were reporting on how a compromise was reached on overall school funding, the budget there for education. What was the compromise that was reached between the House and the Senate, both Republicans in the majority in both chambers? Where does that stand now?
Yeah, the House and the Senate more or less met in the middle at an increase of 2.4% in state aid, which is, it's interesting because it's about the same percentage increase as last year, which was 2.3%, but it's not the same dollar increase, and that's because of a drop in enrollment largely caused by the pandemic. There were around 6,000 fewer students in public schools this fall when they take the count that is used for school funding. And that means that instead of an $86 million increase, which is what the amount was last year, it'll be around $36 million under this plan. So same percentage, but fewer new dollars in the base funding for schools. And another wrinkle of this is because of declining enrollment, there are dozens of districts that would see a drop in state funding. But there's a provision in state law called the budget guarantee, and that guarantees that schools, even if they would have a drop in state funding, they're guaranteed at least a 1% increase for 1 year. And this is meant to help schools with declining enrollment avoid just kind of a funding cliff that they drop off if they lose students. So there would be 137 districts that would be eligible for the budget guarantee this year because of the pandemic-caused drop in enrollment. And they would be able to claim additional property taxes of around $26 million worth. And that's more than three times the amount of property taxes collected through budget guarantees last year. So that's another significant impact. And Democrats say that's a tax increase that the legislature could avoid if they passed a larger increase in the state aid. But Republicans say that, there are other provisions of property tax relief in the bill. And as a one-off, it's not ideal, but it's something that they can work through in the context of years around it.
Okay. Very important education issues in the state. We'll keep our eyes on it with the help of your reporting, Grant Gerlach, our Central Iowa reporter. Have a good day, Grant. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Enough already with this extremely cold weather. Okay, we know we often get a dose each winter of single-digit or sub-zero temps, but this frigidity has far outstayed its welcome. I guess a welcome it never had. It's teeth-chattering times like these. We love to turn to Alan Czarnecki, professor of meteorology at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Ben. Good to be with you.
What's going on?
Well, we've had a pretty active storm track here for the last month or so. It really picked up in Iowa sort of in mid-January. And so we've certainly gotten our share of snow cover, and that's been true for our neighboring states as well. And well, the result of that is the cold polar air to our north has had an easier time surging farther and farther south as that snowpack kind of accumulates over the Midwest. And what happens is the boundary between that cold polar air and the warmer tropical air is shifted gradually farther and farther south. And typically this time of year, that boundary stays pretty much around us. But with the snow cover that we've had, it's allowed that boundary to drift a little farther south than what we commonly see. And those winter storms that we are accustomed to, they tend to form and then move along that boundary between that cold polar air and the warmer tropical air. So with that boundary being farther south, in fact, it's all the way down over the southern U.S. right now. We've had those active storms hitting parts of the country that are not accustomed to that, unfortunately. Storms this time of year in Texas are not unusual, but the coldness of the polar air right now is greater than what it typically is. And so what normally would probably be falling as rain, mm-hmm. unfortunately for our friends to the south, is ending up as freezing rain and snow right now.
Right. Yeah, my brother in Dallas showed me his little patio with some snow on it. Not that unusual. Maybe occasionally once a winter can happen in Dallas. But even further south, I saw pictures of the beaches of Galveston, the first snow on those beaches in 12 years. So, yeah, not this little tongue as we typically think of this polar vortex reaching down to, you know, into the Midwest, but it's really a stripe across North America, isn't it? All the way down to past right. Texas, yeah.
Right, yes. I think Dallas had a new record low this morning. They got to one below. That's the third record low in a row here in recent days. And the lows, you're right, all the way down along the Gulf Coast of Texas, were in the teens and low 20s, which is very unusual. In fact, most of the state of Texas had snow cover already as of yesterday. So there's just mm-hmm. patches that are still bare ground. So quite unusual and may take a little while for all of that to go away.
Mm-hmm. For us in the Midwest, Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois, the Dakotas, is it colder than usual here or is it just more prolonged?
Well, it's both. You know, often we get into these cold periods, but that coldest air that slides down over the Midwest this time of year tends to be rather short-lived. It moves on to the east and modifies as it moves on. But again, that rather extensive snowpack that we have right now, it just makes it easier for that cold air to make it south without having to be modified. The bare ground, even though it's typically cold, even when we have bare ground this time of year, the bare ground really does heat that air more mm-hmm. dramatically and warms it and modifies it. So lacking that bare ground, those sort of reinforcing surges of the cold air as it glides down really are quite noticeable. Even though in Iowa, we now have about an hour and a half more of daylight than we did in late December. The sun intensity right now is about 15% higher than it was in late December. But despite those favorable factors, the fact that the regions of northern and central Canada right now, they're still losing more energy than they're gaining from the sun. And that cold air just is sitting there and getting colder. And it's allowed to move south as long as there's nice snow cover for it to glide over.
Right. And what does this heavy snowpack in the Midwest and the frigid weather mean for the weather in the weeks to come that this is likely to stay? We know what our groundhog said, but I want to know what Alan thinks. He was right.
Well, you know what? Things look encouraging in terms of temperature. I think we're today is probably going to be one of the last of those coldest days, at least for the foreseeable future. I think, you know, Wednesday will still be on the on the cold side, but slowly we're going to start moving back towards normal. Normal is going to feel pretty good.
Yeah.
And we should be closer to normal here. Temperatures in the low 30s across the state by early next week. And then even after that, the outlook is even more encouraging. It looks like we will likely finish the month with above normal temperatures. And that's true even for our friends in Texas. It looks like things will really moderate over the eastern two-thirds of the country here as we get into the latter part of February. Of course, the concern then starts to turn to the melting of the snow.
Yes.
Hope that we don't have above normal precip in March. If we still have a snowpack to deal with as well, that just raises concerns about river flooding. But that's it's maybe a little early to get too worried about that.
Mm-hmm. Does this unusual extreme winter weather this year have anything to do with climate change, or is that just not known?
You know, I would probably credit it to just variability in the climate right now. We're coming out of a La Nina, and La Nina actually typically says that we're probably a little bit more likely to be on the above normal side over some parts of the northern U.S. And while that probably was largely true this winter in Iowa, in fact, December and January temperatures were above normal, not much above normal, but we were a little bit above normal. So that kind of fits the general La Nina pattern. So this sudden, you know, cold outburst just kind of is a bit of an anomaly in a La Nina year, but certainly we can have those.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but we didn't know weeks or months ago this was likely to happen, or there was a greater chance of this prolonged polar vortex?
No, I would say that you know, having that kind of guidance well ahead of time is maybe a little bit beyond our capabilities right now. But again, certainly in terms of just the variability that you see in a given season, you know, we have set a few record lows, and we have set a few record low high temperatures in Iowa with this recent cold outbreak. But I wouldn't necessarily classify it amongst some of the worst that we've had. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, maybe some listeners remember as well, the latter part of January and the first couple days of February in 2019, we got into an eight-day stretch there with temperatures where lows were below zero across most of the state. It kind of culminated on January 30th. Mason City on January 30th had a high temperature of only 17 below. So that was an unusually cold stretch that we had there 2 years ago as well.
Okay, Alan Czarnecki, thank you for giving us a look at the whys and the what's to come of weather in our area. Professor of Meteorology at the University of Northern Iowa. Stay warm, Alan, and thank you again.
Thank you very much.
One thing we've had in our minds in the past few days, how in the world do birds, squirrels, and other creatures cope with such frigid cold? When we come back, Iowa State University wildlife biologist Jim Pease explains how creatures great and small manage these extreme conditions. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Iowa Republican leaders encourage wearing a mask at the Capitol, but oppose making it a mandate.
We have no way to enforce that, even if we were to say everyone in the caucus has to have a mask.
This worries Democratic leaders.
I'm concerned and want to avoid, you know, turning the legislature into a super spreader event.
Legislative leaders share their goals and concerns, and so does the governor on the podcast Under the Golden Dome. Listen to the new episode now at iowapublicradio.org.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, hoping you're keeping warm on this frigid day. Hopefully not too many more frigid days ahead of us this February 16th. Much of the country seeing this historic winter weather having to do, as Alan Czarnecki explained last half hour, with this icy friend to the north, the polar vortex, this mass of cold air spinning over the Arctic, up into the stratosphere, normally staying more or less stable over the North Pole, keeping that cold air penned in over the Arctic. This is not a normal winter, creating all kinds of rolling blackouts, havoc for parts of the country not used to freezing temps, ice and snow. Let's learn this half hour how wild creatures, wildlife, great and small cope with the extreme cold. Jim Pease is with us, wildlife biologist, emeritus associate professor at Iowa State University. Jim Pease, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Ben. Glad to be here on this cold day. I'm glad to be inside, actually, on this cold day.
Right, because every one of us have these thoughts, oh, I am glad I'm not, you know, the squirrel dashing across the backyard, or those birds that I just disturbed in the bush, those poor things. Are they the poor things that we make them out to be? How in the heck do they cope? Let's start with letting our listeners know that they can have a question or two for you this half hour for Jim Pease, wildlife biologist. A question when it comes to braving blistering cold temps for our wildlife. What have you witnessed? What do you want to know more about? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Okay, Jim, on to you. Does it make sense to break it apart into categories, birds and mammals, when we talk about coping?
Yeah, it does. Basically, everything has the same needs that we do for food, water, and shelter. And even during the winter months, they have to satisfy those basic needs. They don't have the opportunity to have a heated building to go into necessarily, although some things need other kinds of shelter. You mentioned the squirrels running across the lawn. They, for example, I noticed for the past 8 or 10 days, we usually have lots of squirrels at our feeders, and right now, the last few days, especially as it's really reached down into the below zero temps, very few squirrels are out. They are holed up, if they can be, inside a cavity of a tree or someplace, maybe in your attic, trying to sleep it off, if you will. And they're living off their fat reserves. And I can tell you, the squirrels around here have plenty of fat reserves too.
Right.
To live off of.
Yes, I've got fat squirrels. Come to think of it, I haven't seen many of them around my backyard either. If we could peer in X-ray vision into their nests, are they? We know dog piles, but are there squirrel piles to keep warm?
Well, there may be more than one inside a nest. More often, it's just one. The nests are preferably lined with grasses and or leaves, but probably leaves, and they're in the sort of the middle of it to sort of provide some extra insulation, but they also then roll up in as tight a ball as they can. Their tail is often over their nose and their eyes, and so they're trying to make themselves as round as possible so that they have the least amount of exposure to the cold, and that allows them to then keep their body heat inside. The same is true with other critters right now, skunks and raccoons. They're all kind of holed up waiting. This is normally the time of year where skunks are out running around. The male skunks are out checking out their girlfriend's overwintering quarters to make sure they're all ready and that they're safe. So being Valentine's Day, you know, the skunks are out there seeking, looking for love, and the male skunks are usually out. But they, during much of the winter, they're holed up sleeping. Even things like chipmunks are not true hibernators, so they will actually have they're holed up sometimes in trees, often underground or under your porch, that sort of those sorts of areas, and they're curled up in a ball trying to stay as warm as they possibly can. The difference for those kinds of critters is that they do wake up sometimes during the winter, throughout the winter, not in these really cold spells, but in normal temperatures, they'll wake up and eat. In the case of chipmunks, they have pantries of food that they've stored in other parts of the den complex, and they'll get up and eat. Or squirrels will come to your bird feeders.
Yes.
or other areas to dig up acorns, that sort of thing. So they're all moving towards spring, but these really cold days, they're holed up as much as they can. Other mammals, of course, have actually hibernated. We have things like bats that hibernate through the winter. Hibernation means that they're lowering their body temperatures all the way down, so their heart rate is very, very slow. They're breathing, just a one or two breaths a minute. They're really very, very, their whole metabolism is reduced, and they have to live off of their fat reserves, just like woodchucks or groundhog, another name for them. And 13-eyed ground squirrels. Those are the true hibernators that we have, and they're living off their fat reserves. Bats, in this very severe cold weather, if they're holed up in a tree, they may be in trouble. They have really a very narrow range of temperature.
So Jim, before we get to some listener calls and social media, you mentioned the bats there, and for bats perhaps. So this type of prolonged deep freeze can have an impact on populations, no doubt.
Yeah, it certainly can. These kinds of long periods of very severe cold really tax their ability to survive. In fact, it's often right during the middle of these that if you have bats in your attic that hibernate over winter in the attic, they may have to wake up, move down. I used to get calls about this from people all the time. They move down into the walls of the house, mm-hmm. trying to a warmer spot, and they go back into hibernation. But that's a very expensive move because they have to bring their metabolism all the way up to normal, move down into the wall, and then take it all back down again. And they may not survive the winter. And then some bats, of course, in this kind of severe cold, may not survive enough to even make the move, or have anywhere to move to. So, yeah.
Okay. Let's. I think we haven't touched on birds yet. Let's have Lauren, who's calling from Deep River, start us off in that category, because Lauren, I think, welcome to the program. You have a question about birds.
Well, yeah, I do. Thanks for taking my call. So I've got about 8 chickens and 3 Muscovy ducks, and they have a place to be. They've got like a 10x10 coop, and I put a little heat lamp in there, but I'm just getting a little worried about them. Are they going to be okay? I let them out in the run each day and try and give them feed and make sure their water's still open, but it's just been so long, so cold, you know?
It has, Lauren. Good questions. Jim, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, though, as long as they're out of the wind and you put some supplemental heat in there, they certainly are good. Birds in general are pretty protected against these kinds of severe cold. As long as it doesn't go on for, too many weeks at a time, they're pretty protected by their down. The down are those fluffy feathers underneath their contour feathers that you normally see on top. And those fluffy feathers, just like your down coat will do for you, it creates basically dead air spaces underneath their contour feathers. And those dead air spaces are what provide the protection. Just like insulation in your walls and your attic, mm-hmm. it's that fluffy stuff that provides those dead air spaces that provide insulation from the cold. They're down underneath their feathers. As long as they're able to keep clean and keep those feathers clean by through preening and other things, they're going to probably be just fine. They're used to being outdoors. Now, their feet, even though they have very little blood supply to their feet, sometimes if they're in a roost spot in severe cold, we used to live in Wisconsin, and we had a rooster that had his toes partially frozen off one winter because of severe cold. But, yeah. I think you're doing the right thing. They're fine.
Okay, Lauren, while we're on the topic of domestic fowl, Becky, a Facebook friend of mine, posted a picture, Jim, I wish you could see this. She took a picture of one of her hens riding on the back of one of her goats and says this particular hen just loves not to put her feet in the cold snow and ice. So I wonder, you know, this is
a smart hen.
Right. This is a domesticated animal, but I wonder in the wild, are there any examples of one mammal using another or a bird using a mammal like this to keep a toes warm in this case?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge. Although there's an awful lot we don't know about the wild world, and there may be some things like that. You often see things on the internet that continue to surprise us. So
right.
I won't say it doesn't exist, but I don't know of any right off.
Okay.
But this domesticated chicken sounds like she's a pretty smart hen.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left with Jim Pease, wildlife biologist at Iowa State University. Let's go through some of these questions. A lot of people want to talk to you, Bill. Let's go to Sac City. Talk to you, Jim. Bill is on the screen. Got those mixed up. Sorry. Maybe the cold affecting my brain here. Bill in Sac City, you're on the air with Jim Pease.
Good. Thank you for taking my call, Ben. And Dr. Pease, considering the snow cover, which has an icy crust surface or under the surface of the snow, and these very extended cold temperatures, how do pheasants survive, and what's their mortality in periods like this?
Mm. Yeah, it's a great question. It's not just pheasants. Pheasants are certainly lots of things use the snow itself for insulation, because snow crystals, of course, have dead air spaces between. But what you mentioned is that icy crust. Depending on the thickness of that crust, it can be very deadly. There's no question. Pheasants will often, pheasants and other grouse-like birds will literally dive into the snow and kind of bury themselves underneath the snow. And that provides some wonderful protection. If that ice crust is so thick that they can't dive through it, and that would be more than, I would say, depends on the how thick it is, but probably less than a quarter of an inch, they should be okay. They can kind of get through it. But more than that, and they're going to have a very difficult time. Mortality can be quite high where they don't have other kinds of protection. For example, lots of landowners, including myself, I have out on my property lots of brush piles. The derecho provided a whole lot of downed limbs to provide mm-hmm. even more brush piles. And the birds, large and small, including pheasants and lots of songbirds, are using those brush piles that often then get snow on top, sort of like an igloo. And they get underneath there and can provide them some not only protection from the wind, but protection from the cold. It helps insulate them quite a lot. So mm-hmm. that's a very, very good practice to do on the land. But in wide open spaces with a crust on the snow, it can be deadly to pheasants and other birds.
Jill from Hills has a follow-up on the pheasant question we had there from Sac City. Jill from Hills writes, is it a good idea to feed pheasants this cold winter? If so, what food?
Well, certainly you can do that, and birds have to have food during the winter. Birds actually, from songbirds up through pheasant-sized birds even, take the food energy that they get from eating, be it wild natural food on shrubs and grasses, to the birds the food in your bird feeders. They convert that food energy to heat energy. Small songbirds will actually at night in their roost sites will be shivering underneath their feathers, and their feathers are all puffed out. You've probably seen some chickadees sitting around today with their kind of, they look like they're hunkered down and they're kind of puffed out, and they're trying to increase that insulation by increasing the dead air space underneath their feathers with their down that they have. Pheasants will do the same thing, and they convert that food energy to heat energy with the shivering, with that muscle activity. If you want to feed pheasants, you certainly can. They can usually find enough on their own. But modern farming techniques leave less and less waste grain in the field. So anything like corn is a really good winter feed for them. They eat other things as well, but certainly corn is on the top of their list.
Mm-hmm. In a recent walk I had a couple days ago with my wife along the Iowa River, we certainly saw our shared a dozen in one view of bald eagles. But and I saw in one of the newspapers today, perhaps you saw the picture as well. Yeah, we've got bald eagles out there, mature ones. They have ice hanging off of their faces, off of their beaks. They can't be happy about that.
No, that's for sure. And usually they'll be able to break that off fairly quickly. I've had people calling me, too, about seeing waterfowl with lots of frost on the outside of their feathers. Waterfowl in particular, we have near me in Ada Hayden Heritage Park, we have an area of water that the geese, the hundreds of geese, and actually trumpeter swans that roost there, have kept the water open. And in these severe cold temperatures, you still get kind of a fog coming off that water because it's such a different temperature from the air above it. And that fog will then form a frost on the outside of the feathers of some of those birds. As long as it's on the outside, they're okay. That means that their waterproof protection, that they smear the oil from a special gland on their body on the outside of their feathers to help waterproof those feathers. As long as the frost is on the outside, they're okay. If through dirt or through a lack of the oil gland or some malfunction, if they allow that wetness to get inside the down, they're going to die. There's no question. But on the outside, it's okay.
Okay, let's go to one more caller at least, Jim. Let's go to Marion. I hope I'm getting your name right. It's Makina. Is that you?
Oh, McKenna.
McKenna. McKenna, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us. We don't have much time left, but what's your question for Jim?
My question is, does feeding birds and squirrels in the winter actually put them at risk for, you know, getting them out in the cold and stop them from doing things that would protect them more, like hibernating or going south or anything like that? Could it be actually bad to feed them?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
A question a lot of people have had. The research shows that it, in fact, doesn't. Birds, for example, bird feeders come through the winter. The survival of birds that are fed versus birds that are not is not really any different. But they do come through the winter in slightly better condition and have very slightly larger brood sizes come the following nesting season. But it doesn't make them dependent. So you don't have to worry about, there's no research indication yet that they become so dependent that they forget how to feed on natural foods. Bird feeding has extended the northern range, or apparently extended the northern range of some species of birds, a few songbirds, things like cardinals, now seem to winter a little farther north. But on the other hand, so have plants done the same thing. We have robins here at our bird bath. Every day, they're out there right now getting water. And what are they doing here in the wintertime? They're feeding on the berries of plants that are available in the woods. Those berries are all freeze-dried. They have to take in water in order to process those berries. So they're getting water from our bird baths that we keep artificially open with a heated bird bath to It's not like a hot tub for them. It just keeps it barely above freezing, so that it is open water for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are lots of things. Should they be farther south? They seem to be okay. They're doing fine in the cold, as long as they have something to feed on. Food, water, and shelter. Those are the three things that they have to satisfy. Insect-eating birds go south anyway because there are no insects available for them in the winter. So, the research so far shows that it doesn't really change their behavior all that much at all.
Okay. Help out our friends in the wild to get through this extreme winter weather. Jim Pease, thanks for the tips and the observations and the science. Jim Pease, wildlife biologist with Iowa State University. Thank you, Jim. Until next time.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, tomorrow on this program, I want to thank our listeners. A lot of calls and questions we didn't get to, but we'll have to have Jim back on the program. And, of course, he appears regularly on Charity Nebbe's Talk of Iowa. River to River, produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Catherine Perkins, our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
The way Iowans consume news has changed a lot since the coronavirus pandemic hit in 2020. But people here still need to know what's going on in the state every day. What are leaders saying?
The virus isn't going away until we have a vaccine.
How are medical professionals reacting, and how is it affecting hospital staff and schools?
Those weekends where you are on the phone and sending emails and, you know, dealing with people with a very emotional issue has been really hard.
I'm Clay Masters. In 2021, Iowa Public Radio is starting a podcast called Hear First. It's a quick daily show for your work week that catches you up on state news as you begin your day. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters.
Most of the improvement in the unemployment picture comes from more than 90,000 Iowans no longer looking for work.
Find out when high-profile politicians are in the state.
Back at the state fair!
Learn about what's going on in state government and discover Iowans you might not hear about otherwise.
This is the first time I've spoken with a woman without documents who's also unafraid of sharing her story on the radio.
Subscribe to Iowa Public Radio's Hear First wherever you get your podcasts.